Okay, well, I want to begin by talking a bit about what people say about capitalism. And seeing we're meant to be starting from Marxist capital and getting up to the 21st century all within the space of 35-40 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm going to begin with just a few things of what people have said about capitalism, and I want to begin particularly, I'll begin with Marx, because after all we are talking about from Marx's capital, so I should say a bit about that. What people have said about capitalism, and particularly about capitalism when it gets into trouble, because I think, you know, why are we having this talk, actually? This is because there's things happening in the world economy that people far beyond our ranks are starting to get concerned about. And one of the things that Marx talks about, and I apologise to Sydney comrades who've heard some of these quotes before, he says that there's a constant tendency for the apologists for capitalism to say that it's overcome its tendency to crisis, and I think he gets it spot on. He says in Capital Volume 3, business always appears almost excessively sound right on the eve of a crash. Business is always thoroughly sound until suddenly the debacle takes place. And those of you who were at Mick's talk yesterday about what's happening in the world economy at the moment will have heard a lovely quote from George Bush, who just confirmed this by, George Bush is in denial, but he's not the only one, that, you know, everything's sort of fine, we're not having a recession, it's just a slowdown and there is a difference. But the more observant members of the capitalist class and their advisers do notice these things. This is what a guy called Prakash Lungani, writing in the Financial Times, shortly before Christmas 2000 wrote. And then remember, Christmas 2000, end of 2000, what's happening in the American economy the next year, next 2 years? Recession. And he says this, which I think is really good in terms of, you know, how the ruling class don't know their own system and want to blind others to their own system. Only two of the 60 recessions that occurred around the world during the 1990s were predicted a year in advance. Two-thirds of those remained undetected 7 months before they occurred. As late as 2 months before each recession began, about a quarter of the forecasts still predicted positive growth for the country concerned. In addition, they were too optimistic in 50 out of the 60 cases. Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve, told his colleagues in late August 1990, a month into the recession, that those who argue that we are already in a recession are reasonably certain to be wrong. And it could hardly be a better confirmation of Karl Marx's point of more than 140 years ago. Now, this stuff about crisis, I think, you know, it rings true with us now because of what is happening in the world economy at the moment. And yet, in the intervening period between when Marx wrote Capital and the kind of looming recession that we're hearing talk about at the moment, Anthony Crossland, who was a Labour MP in Britain, could say in 1956, apparently without fear of contradiction, poverty and insecurity are in the process of disappearing. Living standards are rising rapidly, the fear of unemployment is steadily weakening, and the ordinary young worker has hopes that would never have entered his father's head. We stand on the threshold of mass abundance. And actually, when he said that, you know, somebody's saying this stuff today, you just think, what planet are you on? But actually, when Anthony Crossland wrote that in his book, The Future of Socialism, published in 1956, he was largely uncontradicted. There's not all these people sort of saying, no, that's not happening. So I want to go back to Marx's analysis to start with that and then try and work through the way in which capitalism has operated and the way in which Marx's analysis can actually explain the way capitalism has operated going from the 19th century up to the present. So, you know, sort of small task really. But I'll try and outline what I can as clearly as I can, the mechanisms involved, and then sort of look at how they've worked out in practice. And we need to start with exploitation. The reality of exploitation, of course, is hidden under capitalism. It's hidden by phrases like a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. But the truth is that billions collectively produce wealth while the resulting profits are held by a tiny minority. And Marx developed this analysis of exploitation not out of his own brilliance, but through his lifelong contact with revolutionary workers' circles. His identification with the working class's ability to liberate itself from capitalism was vital in coming to understand capitalism. On the other hand, the most important thing for the ruling class is not to overthrow capitalism, but to preserve it, to preserve existing society. And the different class standpoints explain, from Marx's time to today, why Marx and subsequent Marxists could provide an explanation of the way the capitalist system worked, while bourgeois economists of all stripes could only come up with apologies for the system, ideological proclamations of the wonders of the market or the wonders of state intervention or some combination of the two. Again, those of you who were at Rick Kuhn's talk last night about why did capitalism go neoliberal will have some idea of the kind of voodoo economics of, oh, one year it's monetarism, that's the answer, another time it's neoliberalism, then perhaps it's economic rationalism, or aren't they all the same thing after all, and then maybe it was Keynesianism after all. So there are really different class standpoints, and actually those different class standpoints allow us to understand why Marxism can make sense of the system in a way that bourgeois economics of all stripes simply can't. And so where did Marx begin? Well, starting from the class struggle between workers and bosses at the point of production, Marx began to try and explain the capitalist economic system from the point of view of the working class, how workers are exploited, how the whole system is founded on that exploitation, and that because it's founded on that exploitation, that the system must inevitably go into crisis. And this is the point that I'll return to. So I'll try and begin by a summary of the analysis developed in Capital. We're going to begin, as Marx begins Capital, with the commodity. Don't worry, I'm not going to give you a summary of the entire three volumes. For Marx, the value of a commodity reflects the amount of living labour. And I'm going to use Marx's terminology. I'll try and explain it in sort of more everyday language, but I think we need to come to grips. If we're going to understand Marx, we need to come to grips with his language as well. So he says, the value of a commodity reflects the amount of living labour expended by workers in its creation, plus the amount of dead labour. And by dead labour, he simply means past human labour crystallised in the instruments of production, your machinery, in raw materials and so on, that is used up in the production of the commodity. The value can be measured as a sum of money reflecting what he calls the socially necessary labour time required to produce the commodity. And here, socially necessary labour, socially necessary, refers to the labour time that it takes to produce the object, the commodity, under normal conditions within the average prevalent skill and intensity in the capitalist production at the time of its production. Marx goes on to say that the capitalist has to purchase the dead labour. They have to go out and buy it. They have to buy the machinery. They have to buy the raw materials, the products of previous generations of work. And they make no profit from the entering of that dead labour, the means of production, the raw materials and so on, into the production of the commodity. They just pass on the value that's embodied in them. The living labour, the human labour power, on the other hand, has a different effect. It has a double value because the capitalist receives a fool's day's labour from the worker. Yeah, you go to work, they make you stay there for the whole shift, but they only have to pay enough in the form of a day's wages for the socially necessary labour time to produce the commodity labour power. Now, what does that mean in more straightforward language? It means that for the wage reflects the amount of value needed to get the worker back to work and to produce the next generation of workers. That's the socially necessary labour time required to produce the commodity labour power. But of course, when you go to work and say, you work in some capital intensive industry, massive open cut mining operation, for example, with, hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment employed by fairly small numbers of workers. You go to work and probably you've produce the value of your labour power in the first half an hour you're at work. But the boss doesn't say, go home now. They make you stay there for the rest of the shift. And actually, it means that the value, the time that it takes to produce the value of your own labour power is vastly less than the value that you're actually creating in the course of your day at work. The remaining hours create surplus value for the capitalist, and this is the basis of their profit. The rate of profit, and it's a phrase that, again, we'll come back to, is the ratio of surplus value to the total capital that the capitalist has to advance in investment in wages and inputs of dead labour in order to make the commodity in the first place. Now, Marx provides this basic account in the first volume of Capital. And it's here, in the first volume of Capital, he's considering what he calls capital in general. That is, he abstracts from the effect of competition between the different capitals or the coexistence of different sectors of the economy. And there's a reason why he does this. It allows him to locate the origins of surplus value in the exploitation at the heart of the capitalist production process. So back to exploitation is the central thing again. However, there is something else that needs to be added, and in the third volume of Capital, Marx does add it. He goes beyond the concept of capital in general and considers capitalism as a concrete system where there's not just one capitalist, but there are many capitals in competition with each other. And that competition is extremely important. So I said earlier on about the importance of the explanation that Marx has for capitalism in explaining why capitalism goes into crisis. And so I want to move on now to look at, well, where does capitalist crisis come from? Now, capitalist economies undergo two basic kinds of crises. The first is what's commonly called the business cycle, the regular booms and slumps that are as natural to the system as breathing. The second is the long-term tendency of such crises to get deeper and more intractable, not on a sort of downhill slope without any ups and downs, but over time to get deeper and more intractable. And as I've just got given the 10-minute mark, I might leave out my explanation of the boom-slump cycle, because actually the boom-slump cycle, the ups and downs of capitalist, there's periods of expansion and there's periods of contraction and so on, actually that's not particularly controversial with non-Marxists. It tells us something, of course, about the anarchic and irrational nature of capitalist production, but capitalist economists all recognise its existence. A bit bloody hard not to. But it's only really a starting point for understanding the longer-term tendency to crisis that is built into the capitalist system. And it's that I want to move to now. One of the contradictions of capitalism is that the rate of profit, that is the rate of return on investment, is continually undermined. That is the thing that for which capitalists live and breathe. It's not just how much profit can I make, but what's the rate? How does this compare to what I had to put in the first place to get it? That's what really, floats their boats. And the rate of profit is continually undermined by an inevitable aspect of the system, and that's the competition between different capitals. Competition forces capitalists to constantly reinvest their profits into more efficient means of production. Capitalists who invest in new labour-saving technology are able to produce more cheaply than their rivals, so their rate of profit goes up. And how does that go? How does that work? Because hang on, if they're investing in more means of production, aren't they investing more in the stuff that doesn't create any new value compared to the investment that they have to make into human labour, which is the only source of new value? How does it work? Well, the first one that does this investment gets a run on their rivals. The value of commodities in their industry is still determined by the socially necessary labour time it takes to produce them. And the innovator, the one who buys the new means of production, the massively more productive machinery or whatever, the innovator takes less than this time. So the average across the industry is still determining the socially necessary labour time, determines the value of the commodity, but they're actually able to produce it in a lot less than that time. But of course, competition never lets them just stand still. Competition forces the others to invest in the new technology if they want to stay in business. So eventually, the investment in dead labour, and Marx also calls this constant capital, so I'll introduce that term now, across the whole industry goes up. This raises what Marx describes as the organic composition of capital, and that simply means the ratio between constant capital, that is the dead labour, how much they have to invest into that, the massive, think again of the open cut mining, for example, massive amounts of machinery worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The ratio of investment in constant capital, means of production, dead labour, compared to the investment in what he calls variable capital. Variable because it's human labour, that is, it's the capital, the investment that can actually produce new value, therefore variable. And that ratio between constant and variable capital he calls the organic composition of capital. As it's only variable capital that can create new value, the process of everyone investing because of the force of competition into more and more means of production compared to the investment in human labour power means that the source of profit has been squeezed. And yet, what can they do about it? Can they become Marxist and say, okay, I don't want to increase the organic composition of capital, I won't invest in means of production, I'll just have lots of workers because I know they're the source of all new value? Well, that one just goes out of business. They're uncompetitive, because everyone else has got the new, more, they're paying out all this extra money and wages and so on. Everyone else has got the thing that means they can produce the same stuff with 10 workers instead of 100. So they can't not do it, because if they don't do it, they can't compete with those who've invested in the new technology and so on. But to do so undermines the rate of profit of every capitalist. Now, if that's the case, then why don't we see the rate of profit just going straight down like that? Why isn't capitalism just this nice, neat line of sort of continual decline? Well, Marx's analysis points out that there are various what he calls countervailing factors, that is, counteracting factors to this tendency for the rate of profit to fall. And it gives a couple of examples that apply pretty much throughout the life of capitalism. For example, automation of the production of plant and equipment, that is, production of the means of production themselves, can have the effect of cheapening constant capital. The class struggle itself can obviously help hold up the rate of profit if employers are able to drive down wages, increase the rate of exploitation of the workers they employ. But in both these cases, there are obvious limits to the effects that these factors can have in terms of holding up the rate of profit. For a start, even if the constant capital is cheapened, that is, innovations in the production of plant and equipment mean that it becomes cheaper, there's always a competitive pressure to say it might be cheaper, but there are economies of scale. The one who invests in more of it can actually get a jump on their rivals. And, of course, the limit to the degree to which you can squeeze more out of the workers, well, there is only 24 hours in the day, and you know, if they're going to come back to work the next day, you probably better let them sleep a bit at some stage as well. Okay, so the more important factors that Marx deals with, and he'll try and start going through some of the actual outcomes of this. One thing he deals with in terms of a countervailing factor to the tendency for the rate of profit to fall is the effect of imperialist expansion into areas of the world that are not yet industrialised. By expanding into these areas, 19th century capitalism was able to establish, one, labour-intensive industries with high rates of profit, that is, low organic composition of capital, and at the same time, they reduced the rate of growth of investment in constant capital in the imperialist heartland because they're exporting slabs of it to their new colonies and so on. But, of course, there's limits to this one as well. As the whole world was carved up by competing empires by the 20th century, the effect of this on slowing down the tendency of the rate of profit to decline also declined. The other countervailing factor that Marx identified, and this is an important one, was the effect of economic crises themselves in restoring the rate of profit. Think about it. What happens in an economic crisis? The least productive firms, the ones that are least profitable, are wiped out by their rivals. You know, I think, truly wonderful summary of the madness of capitalism, the crisis of overproduction. Oh, my God, we've got too much of everything. How terrible. What a crisis. All previous class societies had crises of underproduction, which kind of makes a bit more human sense. But in a recession, in a crisis itself, by wiping out the least profitable firms, the crises actually allow the survivors to acquire their next round of capital on the cheap. You think about one of the ways that BHP became the only iron and steel producer in Australia, because prior to the Great Depression, there were quite a number of iron and steel producers in Australia. Well, actually, the Great Depression wiped most of them out, and BHP bought up all of their plant and equipment, all their constant capital, very, very cheaply. Some productive capacity is totally wiped out as firms simply close their doors and never reopen, their constant capital gone forever. And both these effects drive down the value of constant capital and thus restore the rate of profit, at least for a period. In a further indication of the irrationality of capitalism, of course, wars do the same thing. And this effect of economic crises themselves, you can see in the 19th century, it led to both soaring booms and horrific busts. But as with all of these countervailing factors, there are limits. The wiping out of productive capacity also cannot stop the long-term tendency of the rate of profit to fall, and therefore for prices to recur, and also for prices to tend to deepen over time. And the reason for this comes back to that other central thing that I mentioned at the start, exploitation one, competition the other. It comes back to competition. It drives the small firms out of business. It's just the normal operating of the capitalist economy, boom or slump. Competition drives the smaller, less efficient producers out of business, creating modern economies dominated by a small number of large capitals, more and more interdependent. And so by the early 20th century, this process of concentration and centralisation of capital created the forerunners of today's multinational corporations, sometimes described as the era of monopoly capital and certainly the era of imperialism. And these first great companies, the beginning of the modern multinational, depended closely on their national states to defend their interests, the dynamic that led to the First World War in 1914. And so by the 1920s, because of this concentration and centralisation as a result of competition, rather than bankruptcies restoring the rate of profit by wiping out or massively cheapening through bankruptcy the cost of constant capital, it could mean letting them go bankrupt could actually mean these giant corporations dragging others down with them. And capitalists everywhere began to think that this might not be such a good idea, that it was too unstable, too insecure, could actually generate, you know, massive social crises, you know, working classes getting out of control and so on. But also they never knew if the neighbouring capitalism goes down, will I be crushed in the fall? And so capitalists everywhere turned to states to protect them. And during the Great Depression of the 1930s, letting giant corporations go bankrupt threatened to pull the healthy ones down too. And therefore you saw in a range of countries the beginning of a process of heavy government intervention to try and hold up in a way to stop the crisis being let rip because of the dangers that the larger size of the units of capital had created. And so there were trade wars, there was protectionism, there was heavy government intervention of a variety of kinds, from Roosevelt's New Deal in the US to things like, you know, the much more statized economies like Nazi Germany, Stalin's Russia, obviously different origins in each of these cases. But, you know, some of the emerging populist regimes in the 1930s and 40s in Latin America, which all moved towards the state playing a role in trying to regulate rather than just letting the market rip because of the dangers that were now inherent in that. And in the 1930s, this did create some stabilisation, but it wasn't enough. Actually, precisely because they wouldn't let the crisis rip, the rate of profit didn't resume to anything like the level that the capitalists were going to be happy with. But they found another solution presented itself. Again, not for reasons of them working out Marxist economics and then trying to apply it, but because of the needs of their class. It wasn't propping up the major firms that solved the crisis. In fact, that helped to slow down any solution to the crisis. It was World War II, massive government spending on arms and the destruction of huge amounts of capital, which allowed profit rates to revive once more. Old capital was cleaned out not by competition of the market but by bombs, and the world economy was rebuilt under US leadership after the war. But there was a further effect. Not only did the war make recovery possible, but an effect of the war that continued after the war was over, massive arms spending during the Cold War in particular, made it possible to sustain the recovery in the world capitalist economy for the next quarter century or so. That is, the longest boom in capitalism's history came out of this process, that the staving off of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall went on for a very long time. And this is the period in which that quote I read at the beginning from Anthony Crossland about how, you know, slumps are a thing of the past, everything's onwards and upwards, workers are going to have better lives and all that sort of stuff. This was the period in which that was said. And it was the post-war US military rivalry with the USSR which had an economic side effect that prevented the return to a 1930s-style slump. But before I explain kind of what happened there, I want to say a bit here about the political consequences of being able to explain capitalism. And I began with, you know, how Marx came to the conclusions that he did in his analysis in the first place. But I think here is a good point to look at why it matters to actually get this stuff right. Because given that up to this point, up to World War II, economic crises had been getting worse. That, you know, the Great Depression was called the Great Depression for a reason. It was great. It's like, you know, World War I was the Great War. I don't mean great in a good sense. You know, World War I was the Great War, you know, the war to end all wars. That is worse than all the others. The Great Depression was great because, oh, my God, here we go again. Things are really terrible. And because the crises had been getting worse and the measures to overcome them had been getting ever more drastic, many observers of the capitalist economy, including Marxists, like Trotsky in the late 1930s, were convinced that the death agony of capitalism was at hand. And while the Great Depression turned many people against capitalism, and, you know, in Australia, for example, you can hardly imagine why, you know, workers who find that they have no jobs, will not have any jobs for years to come, are living in shanties made out of Hessian bags on the outskirts of Sydney and so on. You can't imagine why those people would turn against capitalism, but they did. But While the Great Depression turned many people against capitalism, the long post-war boom threw many socialists into political disarray. And so you had a number of, I think, mistaken responses. Some, like John Strachey, the best-known British Marxist writer on economics in the 1930s, had by the 1950s seen the long boom stretching ahead of them, no return to the Great Depression, collapsed into the idea that capitalism could overcome its crises, and therefore the best you could hope for, well, basically all that was needed, not the best you could hope for, all that was needed was to, you know, try and maybe reform the few, you know, little blips that might happen in the system. On the other hand, other socialists reduced themselves to irrelevance by repeating the mantra, capitalism is a system of crisis, while decades without crises unfolded. And those who understood the basis of Marx's theory of crisis used it to both explain, rather than to deny the boom, and also to predict the factors that would eventually cause the boom to end. In other words, they didn't give up on revolutionary socialist politics, but they didn't just pretend that the boom wasn't happening. So how did massive arms spending, what the British Marxist Mike Kidron dubbed the permanent arms economy, deflect the tendency of the rate of profit to fall? Simply put, government spending on arms was effectively a waste. I mean, Marx uses the phrase, a robbery committed against accumulation. That is, surplus value that would otherwise have gone into expanding constant capital, into expanding because of the drive of competition, expanding the means of production, investment in that, was instead ploughed into weapons of mass destruction, which means that it didn't go back into the process of production. It sort of went off, you know, like burying it in a hole in the ground. But while a capitalist would never agree to, you know, putting some of their profits in a hole in the ground, they would agree to this because capitalists in every state, you know, no capitalists are running their own armies or anything. Actually, the state taking some of the surplus and using it for military expenditure made perfect sense from their point of view as the capitalist class. And so the drag downwards on the rate of profit was slowed by this. The Cold War arms race, you think about the extent of it, from the end of the Second World War right up to the collapse of the USSR in 1991, US military spending over that whole period averaged about 10% a year. And with so much of US investment flowing to nuclear weaponry that was periodically scrapped as obsolete, the world's biggest economy avoided the rapid build-up of industrial capacity that would otherwise have led to a rise in the organic composition of capital. And this continued, that I mentioned in the 1930s, you see the beginning of this process of, you know, what has later been dubbed state capitalism. We often think of state capitalism as just being about an explanation for the statized economies of Russia and the Eastern Bloc, China and so on. But actually, this process of increased state intervention in the economy began in varying forms across much of the world economy in the 1930s and continued in the era of the permanent arms economy after World War II. It took, as I said, different forms in different states, but I'm not going to go through that at this point. But the permanent arms economy, despite its name, was not permanent. It could only postpone the re-emergence of crisis for a certain period, because again, there was a dynamic within capitalism that meant arms spending would diminish. Again, it has to do with the competitive nature of the world system. The cost of arms spending was borne very unevenly. And when costs are borne unevenly amongst capitalists, then you can guarantee somebody's thinking, I can get a head out of this. And they did. The US, Britain, France and Russia paid the price. They were the ones whose surplus went into the massive arms production of the post-war period. The losers in World War II, particularly West Germany and Japan, were denied the right to rearm, and they put all of their investment into production. They didn't waste any of it into arms production. And, of course, over the decades, the previously weak, you know, smashed up in the war, relatively undeveloped at the end of World War II anyway, in the case of Japan, these reasonably previously weak economies began to emerge as economic powerhouses. And as this happened, the military superpowers scaled back the percentage of their economies devoted to arms. The World Economy Bank began to slow down in the mid-60s, and while there was a brief upturn in around the Vietnam War, the post-war boom was well and truly over when worldwide recession returned to the system in 1973 to 74. The heightened competition, in other words, stimulated investment as they saw that Japan and West Germany were out-competing them economically, and as the out-of-date technology with which British and US industry were operating, because they weren't reinvesting at the same rate because they were siphoning off their surplus to arms spending. The heightened competition stimulated investment in industrial capacity relative to the workers employed, and since profits can't be made without workers, the overall rise in the organic composition of capital ultimately led to the fall in the rate of profit in the way that Marx had observed a century earlier. And since then, the boom-slump cycle has continued to operate, allowing periodic recoveries in profit rates since the return to crisis in the mid-70s. So there have been periodic recoveries in profit rates, but even at the heights of the upturns since then, the rate of profit has not returned to the levels of the glory days of the long boom of the 50s and 60s. I just want to say a few things briefly about how have profit rates recovered since the 1970s. Again, because we're not looking here at this just sort of straight line downwards. Even since the return of crisis in the mid-70s, there have been ups and downs and so on. And it's worth having a quick look at how that's happened. And we will therefore enter the 20th century, the 21st century, enter the 21st century. So the first way in which profit rates have recovered since the 1970s is, in a way, the most obvious, you know, the thing that we can sort of see and that they can hide the least. An increase in the rate of exploitation by attacking workers' living standards and organisations, and also by cutting state expenditure on workers in the form of things like, you know, the attacks that have been pretty much around the world on things like workers' pension schemes. You know, because actually the more user pays is the same as a wage cut. The second thing that's actually underpinned the recovery of the profit rate since the 1970s has been a slowdown in the growth of the ratio of investment to workers through bankruptcies, and also through the growth of unproductive expenditures at certain points in that period since the 1970s. The growth of unproductive expenditures, arms spending once again, luxuries for the rich, the growth of managerial hierarchies, also waste, and speculative investments. From around 1980, recessions began again to involve large-scale bankruptcies for the first time since the 1930s. You think of some of the, well, most of you probably aren't old enough to remember these, but, you know, in the 1980s, a whole series of quite major world corporations went bankrupt. They disappeared. Eastern Airlines and Pan Am in the airline industry, Texaco in Britain, Maxwell Communications, a major media empire, went down. And during the US recession of 2001 to 2002, and these examples will be more familiar to the younger comrades amongst us, think about the big scale of bankruptcies in things like Enron. Enron, and I'm saying Enron, this is the biggest bankruptcy ever, until WorldCom, that was bigger too. Now, but there's another way in which these bankruptcies have flowed through, and it hasn't just been the bankruptcies of particular major corporations, although that certainly had an effect. British Marxist Chris Harman wrote in 1982 that he thought one of the things that might allow the system to revive the rate of profit would be two or three advanced countries going bankrupt might provide the system with the opportunity for a new round of accumulation. And in fact, there have, of course, been some countries gone bankrupt. Not the advanced countries that perhaps he was speculating about at that point, but there have been bankruptcies pretty much of whole states, most notably the USSR, again, as the rate of profit was no longer high enough to cover equipping themselves for the international competition that they're engaged in through Cold War military competition. But, again, this was only a limited return to the old mechanism of using recessions to clear out unprofitable capitals for the benefit of the survivors. And right through this period, we've seen, while some have been allowed, the market's been allowed to rip in some circumstances, and that has played a role in restoring the rate of profit. In other situations, states have made decisions, and states operating as they do as the kind of executive committee of the capitalist class, trying to work out what's going to save the class for whom they work. They propped up Chrysler in 1979 to 1980. The savings and loans crisis in the United States in the late 1980s saw the same thing. This year, or the last 6 months or so, we've seen the Northern Rock Building Society in Britain being effectively nationalised, propped up rather than being allowed to go bankrupt. And, of course, more recently even than this, Bear Stearns, the finance body, being propped up basically, it's state intervention. The state propped them up and forced someone or allowed someone else to buy them extremely cheaply. So rather than just let them go bankrupt. And precisely because the rate of profit has not been restored enough to make the capitalists confident to invest in actual production, there's been a massive growth in speculation. And again, before I conclude, I'll take you back to something that Marx says about this, because I think, you know, the relevance of capital, written as it was, you know, well, published in 1867 for the first time, but written obviously over a longer period. The first chapter of volume two of Capital, Marx talks about how, you know, for the bosses, you know, this thing about the productive core of the economy isn't the main thing. Actually, it is the main thing because it's the source of their profits. But they are so desperate to hide from us, the mass of the population of the world, the working class, they are so desperate to hide the fact that it's our labour that produces the wealth of the world that they have to hide it from themselves as well. And so he says this, for the possessor of money capital, the banks and financial houses, the process of production appears merely as an unavoidable intermediate link, as a necessary evil for the sake of money-making. Now, the price of production is nothing. It's money-making that counts. All nations with a capitalist mode of production are therefore seized periodically by a feverish attempt to make money without the intervention of the process of production. And the process depicted here as periodical by Marx has now become a more or less permanent feature of modern capitalism. As more and more bourgeois commentators are now saying openly, capitalism, they do actually have some idea about the productive core of the economy, because they're now saying openly that capitalism needs a massive restructuring on a world scale. I think Sandra mentioned in one of the talks yesterday about Tim Kolbach saying what capitalism probably needs is some kind of cataclysm, the closure of plants and factories, you know, the dumping of human beings as just so much waste. And so to conclude, the system has been able throughout its history to recover from economic crises. But let's not forget the cost. The cost of recovery has been horrendous. It's been imperialism. It's been the dividing up of the world amongst the imperial powers. It's been world wars. It's been the nuclear arms race. Not to mention, of course, the constant ongoing attacks on workers' living standards, on our unions, on our right to organise to defend ourselves. And the cost is not a one-off. The cost has got to be paid again and again as recessions recur. The extent to which governments and employers continue this pressure, even in times like the present, where, let's face it, the Australian economy is not in recession. So, and yet the pressure hasn't let up. All those Howard years, the years of what a great economy we've got and so on, were years of unrelenting pressure by the capitalist class against the working class. And so it's just one indication of the direction in which capitalism is continuing to go. Now, hope springs eternal in the hearts of capitalism's apologists, but they know, the more honest of them will even admit it, and so do we, that there will be future recessions as long as capitalism endures. The importance of Marx's analysis of capitalism is that the cause of economic crisis is located in the process of exploitation and competition themselves. It's not some kind of optional add-on extra like a tinted windscreen or something. Crisis is centrally related to the dynamic of the system, to profit-making. And it's because of this, the tendency to crisis can't be fixed by reforming some peripheral aspect of capitalism. The only way out is to replace it with a system based on human need rather than profits. How often do we say that? And yet all of this analysis underpins, gives every explanation for why the system's done what it does. The tendency of the rate of profit to decline is not an interesting economic insight into the functioning of capitalism. It's not a nice sort of piece of obscure knowledge. It's an explanation of why the ruling class will continue to mount attacks on living standards and working class organisation as long as we continue to let them continue to be the ruling class. Because, of course, they're not the only class that can rule. And so this is also an argument for revolution, an argument to create a society where the mad concept of the crisis of overproduction is literally unthinkable to people who are born into that society. A society where the introduction of labour-saving technology and increasing productivity would actually be a source of benefit and happiness to humanity rather than a source of crisis.